You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here, and welcome to the show. A lot of news, a lot going on, and we are going to get to all of that today. But before I do, I want to let you know that OptimaTaxRelief.com, our proud sponsors of the Tom Hartman Program, or underwriters of the Tom Hartman Program, facing back taxes, IRS liens, bank levies. For more information, OptimaTaxRelief.com. I want to say a special hello and thank you, by the way, to our non-commercial stations. Our non-commercial stations, many of them, in fact, virtually all of them, are supported by you, by your participation, by your showing up, by your participating in their fund drives. I know, for example, one of our affiliates, KBCS, out in Washington State, is having a fund drive right now. If you're listening to us on KBCS, please respond to their fund drive and help them out. KPFK just had one recently down in Los Angeles. And to all of our Pacifica affiliates, anytime that you would like me to record any little short promotions for you or anything like that, please know that we are pleased to do that, because we know that, you know, you're the guys, you're the stations, the people who just, you know, make it all possible. It is so important to us to be on Pacifica. So welcome to the program. The largest gun study ever says, as to quote Zach Bocamp over at Think Progress, more guns, more murder. I live just a few blocks, literally. I mean, you know, we live in the public marina down here in Washington, D.C., and the next big marina down, or the next big place where boats tie up down the river, is the Navy Yard, where a shooter with a history of mental illness killed 12 innocent people. Basically, a couple of good guys with guns, to quote Wayne Little Peter. Police officers and security guards, in this case, fired back. One was murdered. The other ended up in the hospital. Despite having sought psychiatric help a little over a month ago, which raises this whole other set of questions that we've talked about in the past with a couple of different psychiatrists, about whether people who are taking SSRI drugs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, antidepressant drugs, might be, we know that they're at a higher risk for suicide, or are they at a higher risk for suicide by cop using the route of mass murder? And we don't know yet if that's the case with this young man. But the shooter, 34-year-old Aaron Alexis, was somehow able to get enough firepower to commit one of the worst mass murders in recent memory. Wayne LaPierre of the NRA will soon, no doubt, come out from under his rock and once again defend the total and unrestricted use of firearms. But, you know, that shtick is getting old. More and more Americans are realizing, and, you know, just kind of explicitly, it used to be kind of just a gut feeling or a gnawing, but now, you know, just, yeah, I get it. It's time to stop listening to his clown show. And they're figuring it out. That LaPierre is just, I mean, you know, he's paid $2 million a year to protect the profits of a multi-billion dollar a year weapons of death industry. It's that simple. The gun manufacturing lobby and its front group, the NRA, go on and on and on about how the Second Amendment, which, by the way, in the North was designed to prevent a standing army during times of peace, and in the South was designed to protect the slave patrols, should give every American the right to own everything from a .38 revolver to an AR-15 assault rifle. But lost among all this talk about rights and liberties are the rights and liberties of the rest of us, the majority of Americans. We just want to live our lives safely and without the fear of gun violence, and without the fear of gun violence outside our homes or even inside our homes, by accident, by visitor, by little kid, by whatever. I mean, you got about twice as many suicides as homicides by gun every year in the United States. You've got every day some kid kills some other kid or kills himself by accident. I've used guns since I was a kid. They have their place in society. I'm not anti-gun. One of my brothers, the one who's closest to me in age, One of my brothers is an avid target shooter and owns several guns. And when I go back to Michigan, one of the things I really love to do is share time with my brother Steve and my nephew shooting targets in the range he has in his rural backyard. But my brother, like 90% of Americans, supports the assault weapons ban and the universal background checks, and for good reason. It's utterly and absolutely insane that weapons of war should be in the hands of crazed civilians in a developed nation like the United States. I mean, it's just that simple. Other countries with gun cultures just as ingrained as ours have figured this out. That's why after a brutal gun massacre in 1996, a mass murder by guns, Australia said, enough! And they banned semi-automatic and automatic weapons altogether. And that ban was successful. Australia had 13 gun massacres in the 18 years before the 1996 gun reforms. That was 1996. This is 2013. Is that 16 years? I can't do math in my head that fast. Seems like it. They have not suffered any mass shootings since. That's right. Australia banned the most dangerous kinds of guns, weapons of war. And that country is safer now. Australia also, by the way, has universal background checks for all gun purchases. We, the United States, have instead, at the behest of the multi-billion-dollar weapons industry, chosen to go the other route. The route of Somalia and South Sudan. Just this past weekend, two guys were arrested after waltzing into a farmer's market in Wisconsin with high-powered semi-automatic rifles strapped across their backs. They're now thinking of suing the cops who stopped them, right? Like, the people there were like, what? You know, I'm frightened. I don't want to. And they call the police. The police come and say, hey, you know, you're scaring the people. Why don't you just go home?
We're going to sue you. We got a right to walk around and scare the hell out of people.
Where else would that happen except right here in the U.S. or in a war zone like South Sudan? I mean, I can understand it, right, in South Sudan. I was actually in South Sudan recently, a country that's been embroiled in civil war for a generation, and I suppose you can build a case for publicly carrying semi-automatic weapons in a country like that. I mean, after all, they got rebel groups that still periodically shoot up villages. But this is America, not South Sudan. We live in a developed country, not a war zone. And there's absolutely no reason to own an AR-15 or any other killing machine, even less of a reason to strap it on your back and strut around in public. I mean, the basic fact is that more guns, especially the more powerful guns, means more murders. A new study from the American Journal of Public Health looked at gun deaths in all 50 states between 1981 and 2010 and found that when you factor in all the other mitigating factors like race and poverty, it just came down to this. States with higher rates of gun ownership had disproportionately large numbers of deaths from firearm-related homicides. That's a verbatim quote from the study. Janice Orlowski, the trauma surgeon who treated some of the victims of the Navy Yard shooting, said that there's an evil in our society. Do we have time to play that? We don't. Okay, we'll play it when we come back. She's right. There is an evil in our society. And that evil is in the gun industry and its lobbying arm, the NRA, that continues to push for looser gun laws in the face of mounting evidence that lacks firearm regulations and easy access to gun contributes to the death of thousands of innocent people every year. But not everybody thinks this is such a big deal. And that's, like, just totally weird to me. I don't get it. I mean, that's why we put up the website, the Small Penis Gun Club. It's like, we ever get the smallpenisgunclub.net going? It's working. Okay, cool. There you go. Anyhow, a lot of interesting things there. We'll be right back. It's 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, you know, we'll be back a little more on this and your thoughts on what's going on. How do we bring some rationality to the United States? And then we've got a debate with the Reason Foundation. So just think about this. Welcome back, 20 minutes past the hour. Just think about this for a minute. The one of the hospitals here in town, I'm not sure if it was George Washington MedStar? I don't know. Is it one of MedStar Washington. Anyhow, it's one of our Washington D.C. hospitals. I've been at George Washington. I know that's one of our major metropolitan hospitals, but apparently there's another one, MedStar Washington Hospital. Okay, has historically treated. I mean, there are places in Washington D.C. where you can drive through open air drug markets. There are neighborhoods in Washington D.C. where you can drive through and have a fairly high level of confidence that. If you're the wrong person at the wrong time, your car is going to get shot at, or somebody's going to try and hijack it, or whatever. I mean, there's some really, really dicey parts of town here. Not a lot of them, but there are here. And there were a lot more of them several decades ago. And in some ways, in some places, it's getting worse as you know, 30 years of Reaganomics sinks in and the poor get even poorer. But the net of this is that we have a hospital in this town and a doctor who has become one of the world authorities on how to deal with gunshot wounds. So much so that when doctors who joined the military or who joined the military and got their MDs in the military, when they're about to deploy to war zones, when they're heading off to Iraq or Afghanistan, They do a couple of rotations in this hospital to learn from is it Janice Orlov? Orlowski. From Dr. Janice Orlowski, her and others there, the head trauma surgeon there, how to deal with gunshot wounds. I mean, we're so expert at it here, right? I'm sure there's a similar hospital in Chicago that probably soldiers deploying out of that area go to. You know, others around the country. But very interesting, the head of this hospital, or at least the head of the, you know, we deal with gunshots in the ER department of this hospital, gave an interview yesterday with the press, and this is what she had to say about the state of America.
There's something evil in our society that we as Americans have to work to try and eradicate. I have to say, I may see this every day. I may, you know, be the chief medical officer of a very large trauma center, but there's something wrong here when we have these multiple shootings, these multiple injuries. There's something wrong. And the only thing that I can say is we have to work together to get rid of it. I'd like you to put my trauma center out of business. I really would. I would like to not be an expert on gunshots.
She would much rather go back to being, you know, a family doctor or delivering babies or whatever. I mean, you know, and I think that that's probably true of every doctor who deals with gunshot trauma. But we have this national insanity, just a national insanity. And it's a really, really genuinely tragic thing. So here comes this largest study ever. Professor Michael Siegel at Boston University and two co-authors. This is published in the American Journal of Public Health. This was not published in the, you know, Socialist Worker Party's weekly newspaper, right? The American Journal of Public Health. And Stiegel and his colleagues compiled data on firearm homicides, Zach Bocamp writes over at thinkprogress.org, from all 50 states over a 30-year period, right, from the first year of the Reagan administration until 2010. So basically, this is the legacy of Reaganomics. By the way, if you look back before Reaganomics, not so many gunshots, not so many mass murders. I'm not sure if this has to do with Reaganomics. This has to do with the exploding proliferation of guns. This has to do with the exploding proliferation of SSRI drugs, or the toxic soup of all three. Or perhaps even a fourth variable. And I'd like you to consider this. That as trust in society erodes, paranoia and violence rise. Just consider that for a moment. I mean, one of the things that really amazed me when I was reading The Spirit Level, which is the second in a series of two books. The first was called Why Inequality Matters by Pickens and Wilkinson out of the UK. Kate Pickens and Richard Wilkinson, as I recall. both, you know, PhD scientists and all this kind of thing, and they looked at inequality in societies, and they compared nations to nations, and they compared states within the United States to states within the United States. And what they found was that the greater the level of inequality, the inequality being the spread between the rich and the poor, high levels of inequality, lots of rich, lots of poor, not many people in the middle. Low levels of inequality would be lots of people in the middle class and not so many poor, not so many rich, right? That the worse the inequality, the higher the levels of inequality, not just the predictable stuff, right? The predictable stuff, like, you know, more poverty and more health problems and dental problems and psychiatric problems and broken marriages and child abuse. But there was actually less civic participation, less trust in other people, genuine trust. People actually don't trust each other in more unequal societies, pretty much regardless of social station. Obviously less happiness in the society. Even among the rich. And this thing about trust, this, and less of a feeling of social engagement, less of a feeling of participation, higher levels of teenage pregnancy, higher levels of STDs. I mean, you know, all those social ills, they all track back to inequality. And when I read that, it was like, wow. So I think that's probably part of the soup, too. Ready availability of guns, high levels of inequality. You add all this stuff together, and what have you got? You've got America, post-Reagan. And if you look at the period from 1981 to 2010, the longest stretch of time ever studied, what they found, what they called fixed effect regression. In other words, more guns, more murders.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And for the racists out there that say, oh, no, it's all about the black ghettos, they factored out race. They took out race out of the equation. Still, more guns, more murders. Fairly, slightly unbalanced. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. This is interesting. CBS News reporting, Jay Carney said the president is implementing executive actions and reiterated his commitment to strengthening gun laws, including expanding background checks to sales online and at gun shows. I don't know how far he can push that by executive action. Some sources said the Navy shooter was hearing voices. But Wayne Little Peter says, hey, sell him some more guns. Voices in his heads might be saying, buy guns. You can always put it on your credit card. I mean, you know, they can be expensive. I mean, we're talking about weapons that can cost from hundreds of dollars to thousands of dollars, in some cases even tens of thousands of dollars. It's big money. Big money. And the weapons of death industry has been making so much money lately. And I should stop referring to them as guns and simply always refer to them as weapons of death, because that's what they are. Anyway, that's what's up there. So as I was telling you, and then I'll pick up your phone calls here, they filtered out from this study age, gender, race, ethnicity, urbanization, poverty, unemployment, income, education, income inequality, divorce rate, alcohol use, violent crime rate, nonviolent crime rate, hate crime rate, number of hunting licenses, age-adjusted non-firearm homicide rate, incarceration rate, and suicide rate. All right, so they take all these things out of the numbers, and what are you left over with? The more guns there are, the more murder there is. It's just that simple. Here's the exact quote. For each 1 percentage point increase in proportion of household gun ownership, firearm homicide rates increased by 9-tenths of 1%. A 1 standard deviation change in firearm ownership shifted gun murders by a staggering 12.9%. Now, what's a standard deviation? That would be 1 degree. That's To put that into perspective, take the state of Mississippi. All of the factors being equal, the author's right. In other words, take out race, take out age, take out crime rates, take out, you know, urban and rural and all that. Our model would predict that if the FSS in Mississippi, the firearm, what's FSS? Percentage of suicides that involve a firearm. That if the suicide rate in Mississippi were 57.7%, the average for all states, instead of 78.6%, the highest of all states, its firearm homicide rate would be 17% lower. In other words, the homicide rate tracks the suicide rate because they both track the availability of guns. Since 475 people were murdered with a gun in Mississippi in 2010, that drop in gun ownership would translate to 80 lives saved that year alone. 11,000 Americans a year die because of guns. It's amazing. That's not amazing. What's amazing is that you've got people like Wayne Little Peter who are paid $2 million a year to run around and rant and rave about how important it is to have guns in order to protect the profits of a multi-billion dollar weapons of death industry. And they're treated like legitimate sources in the corporate mainstream media. They're taken seriously. They go into Colorado and drop millions of dollars into an election, into a midterm election where only a few hundred people vote. They effectively sue so people can't vote by mail. So they take out a large cohort of voters. Why would they do that? Well, there's an old guy who used to work on the Reagan campaign who could tell you all about that. Paul Weyrich had it all figured out. Here's what he had to say on the issue. You have that, don't you, Shane? Here we go.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
Yeah, as a Republican, he was working on the Reagan campaign. Let's suppress the vote. And that's what they did in Colorado by court order. They forced a suspension of vote by mail. So the only people who could vote were those people who, A, could get out on a Tuesday, and B, they may have had a few extra days, but they dialed back on the extended voting. And B, were sufficiently motivated to go to the polls, which were those people who were really upset that Governor Hickenlooper had signed a bill that then the head of the state Senate and another Democrat, who were the two who were recalled, had advanced very, very modest gun control laws that basically put a cork in or a limits on these semi-automatic weapons and big clips. It's like it was Colorado's variation of the assault weapons ban. And they successfully got these guys and won by only 300 votes. It's amazing. Craig in Jamaica, New York. Hey, Craig, what's up?
Yes, hi, Tom. I'd like to say, what more could Smith & Wesson want than an arms race right here in America? They've done it around the world. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they use fear tactics to sell them, you know, the impending race war, the communists coming from Russia or China, who the communists are hardly even communists anymore. And then you get the George Romero films where you got the zombies. The guy envisions himself as the last survivor on Earth, him and his family and his rifle and his two cans of pork and beans that he thinks he's going to survive. Mm-hmm. So through fear, they sell these weapons. But I'd also like to say that the government never wants its male component to lose its sort of like for guns or become all left-handed when they need them for war. You know what? The guy that looks sort of, I hate to use this pejorative, sissy-ish, when we need a guy who's ready to take a gun up and defend the country. But basically, people have watched too many John Wayne films. They see John Wayne killing off the Vietnamese. They see John Wayne in the Herkimer Forest killing Nazis. And they say, if I had a gun and I was there, I could have did a good job. So they're walking around with this envision, talk about psychological problems. They think they're the ones that should have been there at the time, but had they been in war, they would have been terrified.
Right. And in fact, there's a claim made that the shooter had been one of the 9/11 responders, and that might have been the source of a lot of his post-traumatic stress disorder, his PTSD. And if so, you know, chalk one more up to George W. Bush getting people all whipped up with hate and hysteria over a crime. Craig, excellent point. Thanks. Ed in Saginaw, Michigan. Hey, Ed.
Hi, good afternoon. You were talking about before Reagan years and about the homicides and stuff like that.
Well, yeah.
We had about 100 million people back then, and now we got 300 million people.
You're saying we've added 200 million people in 30 years?
Huh?
You're saying we've added 200 million people to the population of the United States in 30 years? I think you're missing a century.
Oh, am I?
Yeah, we had around 100 million people at the time of FDR.
Okay, so what? All right, so maybe we had 150 million.
No, I think the population in the 1980s was around 240 million.
Oh, was it? So we only
gained 50
million since then?
Yeah, it hasn't grown anywhere near as rapidly as it did prior to the 1980s, in large part because in 1960 the birth control pills were legalized, and so even Catholic families went from being 12 kids to 3 kids or 5 kids. But if you're simply saying we have less gun violence because we have fewer people, or we have more gun violence because we have more people, actually. You can look at these as a percentage of the population, and what you'll see is that gun violence has gone up as well. Ed, you know, it's a thoughtful point, and I appreciate you making it, but drill down into the statistics. I encourage you to look at the actual study, because it's fascinating. You can find the links over at thinkprogress.org into the study itself. Jerry in Long Island, New York. Hey, Jerry, thanks for listening to WWRL. What's up?
Yeah, well, thanks for taking my call. And I agree with the study, first of all, that basically says the obvious, more guns, more death. And I agree with everything else you said on this subject. Let me add to that, because, I mean, this is just outrageous, because once again, we have yet another mass fatal shooting with an AR-15.
Actually, there's some dispute about whether there was an AR-15 involved.
Well,
but even handguns,
well,
I mean...
Yeah.
You know, this guy was using...
Well, it's my understanding, he had three different kinds of weapons, and one of them was an AR-15, and so...
That was the early reports.
The only debate is whether he actually used it, yeah. But, I mean, we have all these mass shootings occurring, and usually some kind of military-style assault weapon, whether it's an AR-15 or an AK-47, usually an AR-15 is involved. And again, we have to wonder, how many more people have to be murdered in cold blood with these military-style assault weapons before people's right to life is put above both the corporate special interests?
Well, it doesn't even take a military-style assault weapon. Let's just say that this guy, all he used was semi-automatic pistols. You know, that's still, you can kill people really, really fast and really effectively with semi-automatic pistols. If you're a reasonable shot at all, you can kill a whole bunch of people, and it may be that that's how he did this. But, you know, the question, again, so many guns, so much crazy, and it's like, you know, suicide. One of the reasons that in the media we used to not publicize suicides, and still by and large don't, is because they're contagious. The more people learn about it, the more they do it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And now we get these high-profile murder-suicides, and I think, frankly, most of these are actually suicides. This is death by cop, and they're taking people with them, and other people go, oh, that's a way to go. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Talk media for the rest of us artists in Berkeley, California. Hey, artists.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess it's big pharma. I don't know. I've worked with disabled people for a long time,
mm-hmm.
and I really feel a lot of these psych drugs have a lot to do with this stuff. Instead of mental health checks, what if they, if we started looking at what medications the people are on? A number of those young people at Columbine were on antidepressants.
Virtually all, according to, what's his name? Anyhow, there's a psychiatrist who's written several books on this, and he suggests, and he's been on this program a couple of times, virtually all of the mass shootings that have at least been perpetrated by teenagers have been by teenagers who were on SSRI drugs because they kill affect. They reduce the ability to empathize with others, which reduces the ability to experience depression, but it also causes people to view others as objects rather than as humans, and it's easier to kill an object than a human.
And I just think there's a way to find out what medications people are on, and I think that needs to be released.
I agree. And this is one of the things that the news industry, for reasons that I have not been able to figure out, other than that all the television networks take hundreds of millions of dollars every year from the drug companies, are unwilling to investigate. And I think it's a big deal. Because these are black-labeled drugs. These drugs are labeled, may cause suicidal ideation, may cause thoughts of suicide. And most of these cases, most of these situations, and I think yesterday's was another example of it, these people go into this thinking, at the end of the day, I will be dead. And I'm going to go out in a hail of glory and a, you know, rain of gunfire. Sean in Willingboro, New Jersey. Hey, Sean.
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to make a quick point about the whole gun mass murdering type of thing. I think that it has nothing to do with the access to guns, but if a murderer, if someone psychotic wants to go out and blow up 20, 30 people and kill them and shoot them, they don't need a gun to do it. If you take away guns, they'll just find some type of other weapon to do their nut thing.
That's true, Sean. On the very day that Newtown happened, you know, where Adam Lanza walked in and murdered all his little kids, on that same day, there was a guy in China who walked into a school, a crazed, let's kill the school kids killer. It's almost like God organized this as a demonstration for all of us. A guy walked into a school in China with a knife to kill as many children as possible, and he succeeded in sticking that knife into 30 children and a teacher.
Of course.
Not one person died. Not one person died.
It's like everybody's arguing over the access to guns and how prevalent they are.
But wait a minute, Sean. Wait a minute, Sean. Adam Lanza killed every person he shot at. The guy with the knife in China, he stabbed 30 children and a teacher. None of them died.
Okay, but he had a knife. But if he really wanted to, he could have just stuck everyone in the neck or the heart, or if he was more like smart about it. But
maybe, maybe not. It's pretty hard to stick a knife in somebody when they see it coming at them.
All right. Well, what if he walked into inside of a cathedral or a building full of kids and had a bomb strapped to his chest that could level the whole thing? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like there's many ways to go about. You don't have to take it. It doesn't necessarily take an AR-15, a mass.
I don't disagree. Have you ever shot a gun, Sean?
I have, yes.
Okay. So you know that there's that sense of, I'm doing some little small thing here that's almost just, I mean, you know, it's a quarter of an inch motion, and something incredible happens way over there. Have you ever tried to cut up a big piece of game with a knife? Have you ever, like, you know, gutted a deer or anything like that?
Nah, never. I butchered a piece of steak.
Yeah, okay, or carved a turkey. I mean, you know, it requires some significant effort to tear apart flesh with a knife. It's a whole different thing from standing 20 feet away from something, moving your finger a quarter of an inch, and watching it explode. And I would submit to you that because guns are remote control killing devices, there's a different human experience associated with that than in-person killing experiences.
I just think that the gun control thing has nothing to do with it. A nut is a nut, and if you take away all the guns...
Why is it then that when Australia took away all the guns, they stopped having mass murders? They haven't had one since 96. They had a massive gun buyback program nationwide. There are no more guns in Australia, long guns, except in the hands of ranchers, you know, who have licenses for them.
Well, I think Australia is a whole other land in itself. It doesn't have the political
They're
chaos.
People just like us. They just elected a right-wing government that's, you know, pretty much the equivalent of our Republicans. They have the same debates, the same arguments. They have, you know, largely the same even genetics. I mean, you know, as most white Americans, although there's also a black minority there. I mean, I think it's a pretty good analog. Sean, if you look at the numbers, I suspect you will find that there actually is something to this. Go over to thinkprogress.org and scroll down to the study, largest gun study ever, more guns, more murder, and read the actual study. You'll be amazed. Kathy in Boulder, Colorado, listening on AM 760. Kathy, what's up?
Hi, I wanted to bring up a story along with the gun violence. I unfortunately had to attend a funeral earlier this week for an 18-year-old girl who was shot in Longmont, Colorado, an accidental kind of freak shootings. Her and her cousin had gone into a house where her brother and family friend were, and they thought they were intruders, and she was shot and died. She was 18 years old. This
wow.
happened about 3 days before the vote to eject two state senators because they had voted for a new gun law.
Right.
And it actually got very little coverage, even in the local papers, and certainly not on the national news. And I'm not sure if that happened to be because it happened just a couple days before this vote was going on.
You think the papers were afraid of using, you know, that it would politicize the election?
I don't know. I wish people had been out there and saying something about it. And
yeah.
it's utterly tragic and just another case of, you know, somebody senselessly using a gun. He was a gun enthusiast, 21-year-old shotter.
Amazing.
And see,
if he had thought it was an intruder and he'd showed up with a baseball bat or a knife or something like that, or just dialed 911 or run the other way, which make a lot more sense, frankly, that young woman would be still alive, the young girl that you went to the funeral of. Kathy, thank you for sharing that story with us. It's tragic. I join you in grieving your loss. Hopefully some good will come from this. Some lessons will be learned. Thank you. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And the state of California, through a Democratic, small d Democratic process, the elected representatives of the people of the state of California, representing over 70% majority of Californians, according to polls, who want the minimum wage raised, the state of California is going to be raising their minimum wage. It's going to take 3 years to do it, but it's going to go up to $10 an hour, which is still below where it was in 1968. But they're doing it. This will add billions of dollars to the state's economy, particularly money coming into the state, because many of these large companies that pay very, very little. Walmart, for example, pays 28% below the average for big box retailers. Every night they push a button in every Walmart store in California, and all that money goes like that in a vacuum cleaner to a giant bank down in Bentonville or Arkansas. So instead of that money leaving California and going to Arkansas every night, a little bit more of it will stay in California, circulate in the state's economy. So it's a huge stimulus to the state, not to mention that the workers will spend that money. It's going to be a good thing for Californians. Right now, 30 million workers nationwide are making less than workers made in 1968, adjusted for inflation. I mean, this is incredible. Every dollar increase of the minimum wage results in $2,800 in new consumer spending from that worker's household over the year. The best way to stimulate an economy, bar none. Dr. Adrian Moore, however, Vice President for Policy at the Reason Foundation and an economist, begs to differ. Reason.org, of course, the website. Dr. Moore, welcome.
Welcome, Tom. Thank you.
So a couple of questions. First of all, this minimum wage increase in California is supported by a majority of Californians. It was passed by the elected representatives of Californians. What don't you like about democracy?
I haven't said anything against democracy, Tom. Do you believe that everything the government does, like hoovering up all of our private data? I mean, it's our democratically elected government that is violating our privacy. What do you have against democracy?
If the vast majority of Americans are in favor of it, if their elected representatives voted for it, neither of which I think is the case with much of what the NSA is doing, then I would be in favor of it, yes. I realize there are shortcomings to democracy. The majority of Americans were in favor of slavery, at least Southern Americans for some time. But this, I still don't think that's a strong argument. If the majority of Americans think this is good policy, if some economists, yourself excluded, can build an argument that it might be good policy, and if the elected representatives do it, that is a classic example of the Democratic process, or the Republican process, actually, in action. And I don't understand why you would oppose that.
It is the process. Because, I mean, I don't think that whether something was done democratically determines whether it's right or wrong. It may determine whether it was done in the right fashion or not.
And right, and if it's going to work, if it's going to fail, if it's going to be a disaster, then the people can undo it.
That's true. The people can undo it.
But the fact of the matter is that we've had, ever since 1935, when the minimum wage went into effect, we've had, you know, all these minimum wage increases. I forget the numbers. Something like 38 minimum wage increases since that time. And not once has there been a disaster. In fact, every single time the economy has grown, and not once have the people said, gee, that was a mistake. We need to throw the bums out and elect people who are going to roll back the minimum wage.
That's because the costs are hidden. And that's partly why we do, I mean, why even do economic analysis unless we're going to concede that it reveals things that you can't just see with casual observation.
Well, yeah, the costs may be hidden. I mean, most of the costs of a minimum wage increase are in the form of reduced income for billionaires and reduced dividends. But the benefits are obvious. More spending in a community.
You can't argue that every time that they are always able to pass costs on to the consumers.
They rarely do that.
Some rule we want to impose on them, but then not recognize that also happens when we raise the wages.
The cost, raising
improves incomes, but it also raises the price of goods. And the fact is that
by and large, that's not true.
Today is worth much less than unskilled labor was 100 years ago. You can't. The economy is not an unskilled economy anymore. It used to be unskilled wage labor. Unskilled labor's wages were relatively higher because unskilled work was a bigger part of the economy. That's
a whole completely different argument. And the fact that, and your assertion that when wages are raised, that automatically means that the price of goods goes up. First of all, in most industries, wages represent a very, very small part of the cost of goods. But secondly, the price of goods are typically fixed by marketplace forces, not by wages. And so when wages are raised, what happens typically is that dividends go down, CEO pay goes down, companies find other ways to become more efficient. In fact, efficiency increases. In fact, you can make a very, very strong argument, and I think history throughout the 60s to the 90s makes that argument very, very eloquently. And when you look at efficiencies within companies that follow the years after minimum wage raises, increases, that minimum wage increases drive efficiencies in companies. Therefore, they're a healthy and powerful, positive force in the marketplace.
I think you're asserting a cause and effect that has never been demonstrated. These things all happened during the same times in history, but there was a lot going on there. What I don't understand is why shouldn't wages be set competitively? Why shouldn't wages be, if someone is willing to work at this job for 50 cents an hour less than me, why shouldn't they get the job? Why shouldn't the jobs be determined, the wages be determined by the level at which people are willing to do the work?
Because, are you asking that as a genuine question? I'll give you a genuine answer.
Yeah.
Because capitalism sometimes fails. You have business cycles where capitalism fails, and you have high levels of unemployment. And during those times of high levels of unemployment, the force, I know libertarians don't like force, the force of nature, hunger, need for shelter, those forces drive people to work in situations that they otherwise wouldn't work in. And
yeah,
so
if
government was going to be the employer of last resort, I would agree with you. If we were going to maintain, you know, less than 4% unemployment, no matter what, by doing a WPA or a CCC, and the government is the employer of last resort, I would absolutely agree with you. But we're not doing that. So what we have is a very, very loose labor market. And I'm of the opinion, personally, that if we're going to define the rules of the game of capitalism, the first rule should be that if you want to play capitalism, or actually free enterprise, this has nothing to do with capitalism, if you want to play business and you can't at least pay your workers enough to live on, you have no right doing business in the United States of America.
But why should every job pay enough to live on? The whole idea of a diverse economy is that there are many, many, many jobs on which you can make a living, and there are many jobs on which are not intended. They're at the bottom of the scale. They're not jobs you're
every job should be should make enough to live on, because every human being is worth living.
When you're unskilled, you should not expect to be able to make a living off of your ordinary day's labor.
Why not? You have no respect for unskilled labor?
No.
You think so, just because somebody is born with an IQ of 85 or 90, to hell with them?
Let me answer your question. You have to team up with somebody. Have a roommate, have a wife, or whatever. Other workers in your
I'm talking about things a whole lot worse than that.
Combine your income so that you can have enough income to support a household if you're unskilled. Or you can get some skills and no longer be unskilled. There's many ways to not have to make a living off unskilled labor. Unskilled labor is for people to be in temporarily when they're young, maybe when they're old, maybe when they're unlucky.
But the average age of a McDonald's worker is 28.
It's not a way to make a living, Tom.
I will agree with you on that.
McDonald's.
Adrian Moore, I'm going to leave you with the last word. Adrian Moore, Vice President for Policy at Reason Foundation. Dr. Adrian Moore, you can read all about it over at reason.org. Thank you, sir, for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So is California doing the right thing, the wrong thing? Is it going to backfire on them? Is it going to blow up? What do you think? Welcome back to a place where despair is not an option. Drinking my, I take the subway to work here, the Metro it's called here in Washington, D.C., and get out at Union Station, which is just a few blocks from our radio studios here. And there's a place downstairs where they make fresh juices, which is, those of you watching on TV, I'm holding this in my hand. And it's not on the menu, but the guy knows me so well, I just walk up and he makes it. He knows what it is. And it is a whole beet, a piece of celery, an entire apple, the juice of a lemon, the juice of an orange, an entire piece of ginger, a whole, like, a root of ginger, and celery, a piece of celery, and I think that that's it. And beet, apple, yeah. And it's so good. Bright red, though. It makes me look like I'm wearing lipstick because of the beet juice. But, boy, it's like just drinking liquid health. I love this stuff. So, Louise and I are debating about whether today will be our 500-calorie day. Sunday was a 500-calorie day for us, so we were eating gazpacho and drinking juices all day. And I bought some sushi here, but I've only eaten 3 pieces so far. And I'm thinking, okay, we'll make today a 500-calorie day. A fasting day. I feel so good on the days that I fast. I'm hungry by the time I go to bed, but I wake up the next morning going, wow, do I feel good. I mean, I can't explain it. It's like, wow, energy. And I don't wake up hungry, oddly enough, the next morning. In fact, actually Saturday was our fast day, because Sunday morning we had brunch with a friend at noon. And, we didn't eat from Friday night until noon Sunday. And the only time I felt hungry really was Saturday night, around dinner time. And we ate, I think, 3 pieces of celery, which kind of filled my stomach up a little. And, drank a lot of water. And that was it. It's really nice. I'm liking this fasting diet. Those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, it's called the fast diet. There's a book about it. It's big in the UK. And basically, 2 days a week, you eat less than 500 calories. And the other 5 days a week, eat whatever the heck you want. Although Louise and I are largely vegan. But we have been eating some cheese, a little more cheese and eggs than we might otherwise have, because we think that the 2 days that we're fasting kind of make up for it. Although it's still very rare. I mean, we had an omelet with cheese on it for breakfast on Sunday morning, simply because that was the only thing we could find in the restaurant where we were meeting a friend of ours for breakfast. But so far today, I'm guessing, given the caloric count of an apple and everything, if I drink this whole thing, I've probably downed about 200 calories. And I've eaten 2 pieces of sushi, which are about 30 calories each. So I'll be pretty good for the day if I just eat a few more pieces of sushi here before, and I can do that for dinner. The point of the diet, by the way, is not to lose weight, although I do have a little bit of weight around my waist I'd like to get rid of. But the point of the diet is that when you shift your body from burning, when you stop burning, and you stop eating, as long as you're eating, your body's in this kind of burning mode. And when you stop eating, it takes the body about 12 or 14 hours, and it shifts into what's called repairing mode. And the telomeres, these little things that wrap around the end of every piece of DNA in your entire body, as long as you're burning, they disintegrate. And as the telomeres disintegrate, when they, it's like they're like shoelaces at the end of those little plastic round things. There's a word for them, actually, on the ends of shoelaces. And as those things disintegrate, they basically are determining the lifespan of the DNA, because when they're finally all gone, the next time the DNA reproduces, it just basically disintegrates and the DNA dies. And it's called what? An egglet. That's what they're called. Yes, I think. Yeah, egglet. Yeah, the little thing at the end of the shoelace. And that's like they're called telomeres. And what happens is, and this is the same thing that happens with resveratrol, which is that stuff in red wine and grapes, you know, that is supposed to make you live longer, although you've got to drink like 12 bottles of red wine a day to get a substantial amount, which kind of makes it a bummer. You can buy pills, but the really high-quality stuff is pretty expensive. But your body produces its own if you just stop eating for a day. And it produces massive amounts of it. And so what happens is during that day that you're fasting, or that, you know, it's really like a 24, 30-hour period, during that time you're fasting, your body's just going all through their whole body, just adding to those telomeres. It's actually reversing aging. And which is why Louise and I are doing it, because we've both had a brush with cancer, and we've both, you know, we're both getting older, and we'd like to stick around for a while. Hopefully one of our kids will have grandchildren. You know, wouldn't that be nice? So anyway, so I'm having my and the lemon juice, I don't think has pretty much any calories. The orange juice probably has some calories. The beets got to be low. The celery's, I know, super low. So probably the highest calories in this thing I'm drinking is the apple, and there's only one apple in it. Oh, and there's carrots. There's carrots in there, too. There's probably some. I'm going to have to add it all up. Maybe it'll be 300 calories. Maybe I'll be hitting my limit just with lunch here today. But anyhow, we're having fun with it, and we've been experimenting with this for a couple of weeks. But because it heals, because you go into this healing mode really enthusiastically, I mean, this is, like I said, this is not a weight loss diet, although people who are overweight do report that they lose weight. The main thing is that my blood pressure had been creeping up over the last year or so. And I think part of it had to do with I had surgery last year, and so I hadn't been as, you know, I hadn't been walking around for, you know, I spent like 4 months basically kind of laid up. And I wasn't exercising and things. And so for, about a month or two, I was actually taking blood pressure pills because my doctor freaked out. I went in, my blood pressure was like 195 over 140. And she's like, what? And it's now down to 140 over 85. I mean, you know, which is kind of the high end of normal. So I forgot to take my blood pressure pill today. I'm not sure I need to. Like I said, I'm fasting today. And I think the whole point is to get off them. Medication free.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And what's so cool is I learned about this from a caller to this program. And then I bought the book. It's called The Fasting Diet, I think. And Louise and I read the book, and it's like, hey, this is a, you know, this is cool. Before the hour. I don't know how I wandered off into diet, but, you know, hey, you know, share your life with people. It's Higgins, by the way. People have been asking how Higgins is doing. Higgins is an old cat, and Higgins is not doing well. And at first we thought it was hyperthyroidism, and they gave him that drug, and that didn't, you know, and then they thought it was his kidneys, and then they found out he had high blood pressure, and like, what's that with? And then they looked at his liver enzymes, and they were off the scale, and so they thought, well, maybe he's got liver cancer. It looks like that. And, you know, there were no solutions to any of these things of much value, particularly with a very old cat. And he refuses to eat, and he's just kind of wasting away. And so about a week ago, a week and a half ago, Louise started just vigorously force feeding him every 2 or 3 hours, giving him 2 or 3 5 or 10 cc syringes full of She's got one of these things, these bullet things, you know, they're the things that they advertise on TV, the infomercials, $49.95, and you know, it's like a cup with a blender attached to it. You put stuff in it and you like that, you know, and we make milkshakes and smoothies and salad dressing and all kinds of cool stuff. It's Louise's favorite junk that we bought from an infomercial. In fact, we've been through three of them over the last decade. And so she's, you know, making liquid cat food. She takes cat food, different kinds of cat food, and mashes it up so that it'll go through a syringe. And she's basically shoving it down Higgins' throat, or she sticks it into the side of his mouth between his lips and just squirts it in, and he swallows it down. And after about three syringes, he starts going, yeah, that's it, I'm full. He won't eat it. And he was getting worse and worse and worse. And then about 4 days ago, he had, or maybe 5 days, it was last Wednesday, I think, he had a stroke. He just, you know, he was sitting on our bed, and all of a sudden, he just kind of dropped his head to one side and just looked like, And then he started walking in circles to the right, and he couldn't move to the left, and, you know, he stroked out. So Louise got on the internet and looked this up, and it turns out that cats actually recover from strokes faster than people do. And they need a lot of sleep, and they need some physical therapy. And there's nothing doctors can do about that, basically. So we started, first of all, we're giving him some supplements along with his cat food since then. And Louise just kept force feeding him, making sure he had a lot of liquids, carrying him to the kitty litter box because he was walking in circles and having a hard time figuring out how to get into the kitty litter box. And by Saturday, he was able to walk in a straight line. And Sunday morning, I get up in the morning and make coffee. That's our deal, right, for Louise and I. It's been for years and years and years. And so I get up and I make the coffee, and Louise is like, check Higgins, you know, let's make sure he didn't die overnight because he's down to just skin and bones. But he's kind of stabilized. And I went and checked on him, and this time he actually jumped up out of his bed, and because he had, you know, and he followed me down down to the kitchen, and then he followed me down to the bedroom, and he couldn't jump up on the bed anymore. I picked him up on the bed, and he's, you know, he's like, he's coming back. It's amazing. My theory is that he's got liver cancer, and that the cancer threw off a clot, and that caused the stroke, and that he actually is on his last legs. Louise thinks that it might be something else and that she's pushing him through it, which may well be true. So, but that's the status of Higgins. He's actually, you know, first half of the day, by the end of the day, he's pretty pooped and pretty burned out, but, you know, we just feed him like crazy. But this morning he was walking around. He was even meowing, which he normally doesn't do. But what he likes to do is he likes to just sit next to me and just purr real loudly. It's the only time he purrs is when he's sitting next to me. So that's what's up with our cat. Anyway, we started out with a gun rant. We've talked about California's minimum wage. The Republicans, by the way, the poor John Boehner, he's got this terrible problem. He's got these Tea Party wackadoodles who want to defund Obamacare. And you have to ask this question. This is the question. I'm going to be debating this on TV tonight with some right-wingers. This is the question. If you guys are so certain that Obamacare is going to be a disaster, you should be enthusiastically promoting its going into effect. Because that'll prove to America what an idiot Obama was. Why do you want to stop it? Well, obviously they want to stop it because they know that it's going to work and people will like it. And once people like it, you can't take it away from them. It's real simple. It happened with Social Security. They opposed Social Security. It happened with the right women's right to vote. They opposed that. It happened with African Americans' right to vote. They opposed that. It happened with civil rights. It happened with gay marriage. It happened with the minimum wage. They opposed. I mean, they, you know, conservatives have opposed. Republicans have opposed all of these things. It happened with Medicare. It happened with Medicaid. They hate all these things because they're all ways of transferring money from the rich to the middle class and the poor. And the Republican Party has one mission in life, and that's to represent the interests of the rich and the transnational corporations, the people who own them. They're shills. So why do they want to defund Obamacare? Why are they so desperate to stop it in the literally 4 or 5 months before it starts? Because they know that once it starts, people are going to go, oh, this is pretty good. You know, about half of all Americans who are uninsured right now who sign up for Obamacare are going to pay less than $100 a month for it. Less than $100 a month. I mean, I've been paying between $800 and $1,000 a month for health insurance for years. I think that's for Louise and me, but still. $100 a month? So, anyway, minimum wage, Obamacare. There's a lot of interesting stuff going on. We haven't talked about Syria for a while. It looks like, you know, the process is going forward. As I said yesterday, and I just want to reiterate this again very quickly, and then we'll pick up your calls. I think that we're seeing the second act of a three-act play, and basically it's the repudiation of the Reagan Revolution. And the first act of the Reagan Revolution, you know, Reagan had this doctrine of I can invade anybody I want, damn it, and he invaded Grenada, right? Have a war, makes you more popular. Well, Barack Obama said, oh, hey, I'd like to have a little war. I think it'll make me more popular. Let's do it in Syria. And the people said, no. Act one. Then he said, let's go back to Bill Clinton's policies of, deregulating the banksters. Larry Summers was in charge of all that stuff. Let's put him in charge of the Fed. People said, no. The next act in this play is going to be another repeat of the Clinton administration, which is still Reaganomics. It's still the Reagan Revolution. We have not yet repudiated the Reagan Revolution. And he's going to come forward with the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And you mark my words, people are going to say no, and he's going to have to back off on it. I hope. Matt, in Trona Heights, Pennsylvania, you want to disagree with me?
No, I want to hear your opinion on something.
Okay.
Back on the right of gun ownership or the right to bear arms in this country.
Sure.
It is a tragedy what happened in Washington, D.C., and, in all instances of violence like that are a tragedy.
Certainly.
However, if we take away the right to bear arms, that'll take a freedom away that was granted and given to us by our Constitution, specifically within the Second Amendment in this case. And
I disagree.
How do we weigh freedom and safety? I mean, and I'd like you to comment on Benjamin Franklin Thomas Jefferson's statement that they said those who will give freedom for safety deserve neither and will have neither.
Yeah, liberty was the word that Franklin used. Those who would surrender essential liberty for a little temporary safety deserve neither. And, first of all, the purpose of the Second Amendment was twofold. The Second Amendment was a compromise. And I encourage you to go back and read the constitutional minutes. They're in print. They're fairly easy to find. The debates in the Constitutional Convention, James Madison kept the notes in 1787. Summer of 1787 in Philadelphia. The original argument was that there should be no standing armies during times of peace, that whenever we were not at war, the army should be dissolved. Now, if the army is dissolved, and the reason why was because the founders were afraid that an army could represent a military coup. They had seen this happen over and over and over again in Europe. And so if you dissolve the army, how are you going to defend the country? And so the suggestion was that militias, everybody from 17 to 47 years old should be a member of a militia, and that the militia should be organized at the ward level within counties, responsible to the local ward leader. There should be local gun storage places, whatever they're called, and depots or whatever, and armories. And that the wards were responsible to the counties were responsible to the states ultimately responsible to the federal government. And that there would be a militia. Now, in the South, they already had these militias in South Carolina, North Carolina, and Georgia, and they were called slave patrols. Everybody between 14 and 47, every white man was required to go on slave patrol at least once a week and, you know, look for slaves who had wandered off. So in the North, the big concern was a standing army. In the South, the big concern was they wanted to keep their slave patrols. But it was all about a militia, and that's why the beginning of the Second Amendment says, in order to maintain a well-regulated militia necessary for the security of a free state, the right of people to bear arms shall not be abridged. Okay? So I think we should go back to the militia. They're called National Guard. We've kind of expanded it somewhat. And I think we should go back to doing away with the military during times of peace. That was such a strong belief of the founders. Read Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. The only kind of appropriation that Congress can make that is limited in time, and it's limited to only 2 years, is an appropriation to fund the Army. Because they didn't want armies to last more than 2 years.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So I understand your question. And if you want to go deeper into the question, like, you know, well, what if the government becomes oppressive? You know, somebody give me a shout on that, and I'll give you my takes on that, too. Occupying the media, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's check in, find out what's going on in the world. Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service. Former Congressman Bob Ney, author of an absolutely brilliant book about how politics works in this town called Sideswiped. And this brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com and TalkRadioNews.com. Bob, welcome.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
I am very well, thank you. Getting better every day. My shoulder's healing up.
Go.
Life is good. So, how, you know, what's going on in the world, Bob?
Well, of course, at home, the Navy Yard, terrible situation at Navy Yard. And more facts are coming out about, you know, the shooter, Aaron Alexis. And they're trying to get down to the motive of why. Everybody wants to know why, and maybe that'll help with future issues. But as I had made a commentary this morning, when asked on a radio program, you know, this is not going to be the same gun control debate to have gun control or not, I don't think, as one would see. And I say that because, you know, I've got a couple friends on the Hill, and they seem to believe that so much of the focus is going to be towards the outsourcing of these background checks. And they're starting to find out things that were known anyway, which is that you get a security clearance. For example, you want to work at a Hewlett Packard. You sometimes get the secret clearance before they even do the background check. It's a preliminary approval.
That's bizarre.
Then they go through the process.
Because this guy worked for a smaller company that was hired by Hewlett Packard to do IT work for the government, which again raises the question, Bob, if the Navy needs IT work done, why don't they hire a sailor to do it? Why should they hire a big company to hire a small company to hire an individual? I mean, there's three layers of inefficiency, bureaucracy, skimming money off the top there. And then, you know, there are one of the theories that's been put forward is that this guy was PO'd because he wasn't paid enough. Well, of course he wasn't paid enough. His employer was skimming it off the top. HP was skimming it off the top. And, you know, it should have been a sailor doing the job in the first place, shouldn't it? Then you wouldn't have to worry about the security issues to begin with.
You know, this whole privatization push, whether it's, you know, chartered schools, private prisons, we can go on and on about it. You know, when people would say, well, the private sector, well, General Motors didn't do so good, did they? We had to bail them out.
Right.
And so at the end of the day, everybody likes to trumpet the fact that, well, it would cost the government too much money, but you make such a good point. I thought we're supposed to train men and women in the armed forces, you know, for future things they want to do when they get out. And IT is a great area to do it. And why I hope that whole debate will ensue. I know that the debate's going to be out there about these background checks. They're going to find, Tom, they're going to find all kinds of things out there about companies. Look, if a guy is doing a background check in a private company and it costs $2,000 more than it should have, because we've had these done when I was in Congress for employees, and $2,000 more, somebody in that company is going to call him in and say, hey, you're costing us $2,000 per person. You better speed the thing up.
Right.
And you know that will be a possible scenario.
Right. And then corners get cut, and then you get a crazy guy inside a naval institution.
And from the looks of, you know, the past history, how they didn't catch some of that is, you know, beyond me. And so I think that's going to be debated. And, of course, the safety on the military bases. And the gun control issue itself will be debated. But I think there are people that woke up shocked this morning that, you know, why are people not all armed on these bases? Well, it goes back to, you know, some rules back in 1993 when the decision had to be made whether you want everybody walking around with a gun or not, or do you want the police, you know, who are designated to have them.
Right, and it turned out that it would be a safer society if the police had the guns and everybody else didn't unless they're on a battlefield.
So you've got that, and again, the ID issue, so the Congress will look, you know, will really focus in. So I don't believe, even though it's a horrible thing that happened, I don't think you're going to have the same emotional impact as the Newtown massacre.
Well, no, it's not a bunch of little five-year-olds. But, Bob, question. It was reported that, first of all, it was reported he came in with a shotgun, killed a security guard, seized some guns from them. Then it was reported that the guy had an AR-15 stashed someplace and pulled it out. And now it's being reported by some, and I mean, these reports are all over the place, that no, there wasn't an AR-15 involved. What were the weapons? What's the current state of knowledge about the weapons that this guy had?
Well, you hit the right scenario that, you know, he had taken a shotgun, and then he shot the police officer, you know, who was a Navy person.
Right.
And then he supposedly had two handguns. And they're saying now that there was no AR-15 involved, but he had a shotgun and two handguns, and one of the handguns came from the soldier that he killed.
Right.
So that's what
you got two handguns with somewhere between 7 and 12 shots in a clip. You can do a hell of a lot of damage.
A lot of damage with it. So that's what they're saying now. They went back and said, no, there was no AR-15. I don't know how they got got reported in the first place. But he did use a shotgun, and he had the, of course, it depends on when they say handgun, it could be a Beretta, which could be over 14 shots.
Yeah, yeah.
In a Beretta. So all they're saying is a handgun.
Yeah.
That could be.
Or a Sig Sauer, a MAC-10. I mean, yeah, there's numerous quote handguns, end quote, that are really just small semi-automatic weapons.
Also the president was criticized, which I found incredible, was criticized because he, quote, didn't take enough time. He interrupted the beginning of another event he had, and he mentioned this, but if the president would stand there and try to just off the top of his head speculate on things, it would make it far worse. So I saw that and I just thought, you know, how far do people go to make a point? Wow.
This president can come out and say, I hereby declare that today is the day we memorialize or we all honor little puppies, kittens, mom, and apple pie. And the Republicans would figure out a reason to criticize him for it.
Well, this one was just, I thought, really ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, on another note, there are still some things going on the Hill. Speaker Boehner has a dilemma of 43 members who want to, quote, shut the government down. I think they're going to have their 957th and a half vote on Obamacare, probably.
But he's going to have to turn to Democrats, isn't he, to avoid shutting down the government?
Well, you got to work with Nancy Pelosi and get some votes, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not shutting it down. I'm doing something.
Yeah, you're right. It's going to be very interesting. Former Congressman Bob Ney, author of Sideswiped, now a reporter with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Bob, thank you for being with us today. It's always great talking with you. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Three billionaires, Steve Prenke, owner of the St. Louis Rams, worth $5.5 billion. Stephen Ross, who owns the Miami Dolphins, he's worth $4.8 billion. And Arthur Blank, the $1.7 billion owner of the Atlanta Falcons, are each asking their local communities to build them new stadiums. Isn't that sweet? George, that's how George W. Bush got rich, you know? I mean, aside from the money that he inherited when he was born. Some friends of his dad loaned him a little bit of money. As I recall, it was something like $70,000 or $117,000 or $170,000, somewhere in that neighborhood. And he bought a share of the Texas Rangers with that. And then they went to the city and they said, build us a new stadium, please, using taxpayer dollars. And they built a brand new stadium, and all of a sudden the value of the team went up tremendously. And so he cashed out for millions and millions of dollars. And in fact, there was enough shady going on in there that there were a fair number of people who thought that that was an indictable offense, but nobody ever bothered because he was the son of the vice president at the time. And you know how that works. But here's what I know about sports. The Packers. the Green Bay Packers. It's the every other football team, every other NFL football team is owned by a rich guy. And I think most of them are rich white guys. And the Green Bay Packers are owned by the local community. It was started by the Meat Packers Union back in the day. I mean, literally back in the day, the early part of the 20th century, as I recall. And they distribute shares in the Packers, and people pass these down through their families. And it's a whole, you know, there's a whole, I'm not an expert on the history of it, but it's a community-owned team. So it's never going to go anywhere. Every team should be like that. We should just pass a law that says, you know, rich guys are not allowed to own baseball and football teams anymore. It has to be a consortium of people in the community. You know, sell the stock locally. You have to live within 100 miles of the team in order to own the stock, or at least for the initial purchase. And along with the stock, you get a dividend, you know, based on whether or not the team is profitable that year. And maybe if you own a certain amount of stock, you can get a season ticket or something. And let's turn our sports into what they really should be. I mean, you know, sports is supposed to be proxy for war, right? I mean, it's to satisfy that testosterone-driven thing in men, which is why women don't sit around and watch sports on weekends by and large. That testosterone-driven thing in men to participate in, or at least vicariously participate in, war. And it's funny, over the weekend, there must have been some big game going on this weekend, because the guy who lives in the boat next to boats don't have real thick walls. And the guy in the boat next to us, you know, we kept hearing this, "Wow! You know, get him!" And at first Louise thought this guy was like beating his wife or something. And so she walked out onto the dock and, you know, looked in his boat, and here he is, he's watching a football game with a beer in his hand, or some kind of game. And say what? It was the Packers beating the Red Sox? God bless them. God bless them. See, I would have liked to have watched that. I didn't know. But anyhow, he was going nuts. And it's like, you know, if team sports is supposed to be a surrogate for war, the whole point of war is for my community to fight against the community that is the aggressor or the enemy, that community over there. It's us against them, right? It shouldn't be my billionaire versus your billionaire. I mean, really? This makes no sense to me. My billionaire versus your billionaire. I don't get it. Are people really sitting around going, "Yeah, Steve Kroenke, St. Louis Rams. Yeah, Steve is going to make another half $1 billion in this team just if that guy just gets that touchdown." Oh no, I'm a Steve Ross fan. You know, I'm with the Miami Dolphins. You know, so I want Steve Ross to. No, come on, we're not cheering our billionaires. People think they're cheering their community. My parents grew up in Miami, so I grew up in Michigan. I was always a Detroit Tigers fan and Detroit Lions. And I briefly went to Michigan State University, you know, in college sports, the Spartans. But, you know, when this stuff is saleable, I remember, I think it was the Angels went to Los Angeles from New York at some point in my lifetime. There was a team that went from it was the Dodgers, and they became the Angels, didn't they? Or did they stay the Dodgers? Yeah, from Brooklyn to Los Angeles. They're still the Dodgers. Okay, thank you. See, this is how stupid I am about sports. But the point is, how's that possible? Right? You grow up going, "Hey, it's my team, it's the Dodgers, I'm from Brooklyn," and then, oh, no, now they're with Los Angeles? Wait a minute, because the billionaire decided to move them or sell them. That's nuts. So if we're going to have sports and it's going to be a surrogate for war, you know, I get it. Colleges don't move, so their teams don't move. But this stuff about billionaires owning teams, let's do away with that. Let's just say communities can own teams. Okay, enough of that stuff. We have wandered all over the place in the show today. It's almost like anything goes Friday. It's Tom's rant today. But these things are all in the news, so, you know, it's reasonable. County in North Carolina voted to secede from Northern California, by the way. I'm in favor of that. I think California should split itself into three states, Northern, Central, and Southern California. That would produce two, and that would give us, that would give you four new members of the Senate. And two of them, the Central and Southern California, would be reliable Democratic senators. I think Texas should become two states. I think Florida should become two states, basically Miami and South Florida, and then the rest of Florida. New York City, I mean, you know what, 15 million people, something like that, New York City? That's a state. And then the rest of New York, make that into two states. And if we did that, maybe even Illinois, you know, separate Chicago off and the rest of Illinois. If you did that, then you would have a permanent Democratic majority in the House and Senate, which is why it's not going to happen. But it would be more representative of the will of the American people. It genuinely would. Because you've got all these little states like Wyoming and Oklahoma that have a population of under a million people, and they've got two senators. And then you got California with, what, 20, 37 million people, 27 million, something like that, some incredible number of people, and they have two senators. That sucks. It's just not right. Anyhow. I want to get you involved in the conversation here. Stephen in Burbank, California. Hey, Stephen. Thanks for listening to Sirius Satellite Radio. What's up?
Well, we see that another shootout, and what it is, somebody has to take center stage to make the statement. And the statement is, this is a sick society. It has to change. What it is, I like to call it ongoing traumatic stress. Because as we know, the numbers about how the people are worried about losing their jobs, losing their income, losing their standards of living, becoming homeless, just like you mentioned before. And this is stress. This causes us to stress.
Well, this guy's dad said that he was a first responder at 9/11, and he's had PTSD ever since then.
That's post-traumatic stress. But I'm talking about ongoing traumatic stress.
Oh, just because of 32 years of Reaganomics, you mean?
Well, that and plus the paradigm of competition. You know, you got to get tough or die. You got to go out there and be better in business and put the other guy out of business.
Which is basically Reaganomics. I mean, writ large. It used to be that there was a social safety net. You had some basic security no matter what, which is why people used to be able to start businesses. Entrepreneurship right now is at a 32-year low because people are afraid to start a business. I think that Obamacare is going to make it easier. But that's what's going on. Good point, Stephen. Thank you very much for the call. And thanks for listening to Sirius Satellite Radio. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Oh, yeah, I'm a big supporter of Arthur Blank. I mean, the Atlanta Falcons, because he's my billionaire, right? No, come on. Joining us past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. Rich in Aurora, Colorado, listening on AM 760. You guys have had your share of interaction with gun violence there in Aurora.
Well, and we've also, good to talk to you, Tom. Long time no talk. You have an awesome show. We've also had 6 months of rain in less than a week here, if you take all the counties. I can basically explain this down to how it's all, you know, you posed the question earlier, why the media takes the money. They take the money because like you said several times before, there are no Walter Cronkites and Edward R. Murrows anymore. It's a circus. It's infotainment. They're talking heads. They take the money because we're now a consumerism economy. We're a War Department economy, a check cashing department, and all we do is consume and eat each other from within. We haven't made anything in this country before bedtime for Bonzo Reagan, who, by the way, took away mental health funding. You know, you could take the Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold. You know, there was a movie by Dr. McDream. I forget the guy's name. Pat, what's his name? He did back in the mid-'80s. And it was basically, you know, it's in high school, and he says, you know, cools, nerds, your side, my side. Man, it's all BS. You know, those guys, you know, because they dress a little different. Same with the Memphis Three. You got guys who dress in black or whatever. People are a little different. They say, oh, they're terrorists. Mm. Oh, they're violent. Mm. Oh, they talk to themselves. They hear voices, you know. So naturally, it's easier to get a gun than it is a stick of gum. you know. And that's another thing. You know, I have to get a license to be a scuba diver. I have to get a license to get a car. Like you said earlier, Tom, it's absolutely ludicrous to me. I put one more thing on that point you made. Four, I put etchings and trackings on all munitions, all bullets. You know, and to the NFL, you know, those guys.
Hey, hang on just a second. Before you go on to the NFL, for those people who didn't, because I said that an hour and a half ago, and a lot of people have tuned in who didn't hear what I said. So let me just repeat it, if I may, very quickly, and then I'll let you go to the NFL. I suggested that we should do the same thing with guns that we did with cars. Back in the 20s, when we discovered, when cars got fast enough and powerful enough that they started killing people, we said, these things are capable of killing people, so we're going to come up with three simple things. Number one, from the time they're manufactured until the time they're destroyed, there's a registration number on them, and that registration number has to be associated with whoever owns them, so you get a, you know, a title, and that number follows the car forever. Number two, if you're going to operate it, you have to demonstrate proficiency. You have to have a driver's license. And number three, if you're going to operate it, is because it's capable of causing death or destruction, you have to have liability at the very minimum. I mean, you can have theft insurance and all the other kinds of insurance, but at the very minimum, you have to have liability insurance. So if you harm another person and you personally can't afford to compensate them for that harm, the insurance company will do so. And I think those three things should be the case for guns. Now, what was your fourth suggestion?
To track the bullets.
Oh, right, right.
DNA on the bullets.
Right, to etch the ammunition, yeah. That
absolutely. And, you know, sorry, go ahead.
No, that makes a lot of sense. That's all I was going to say.
Well, and then, you know, to the NFL, I'm like, you know, it's a business. Like you said, Tom, okay, you want to do business in America, you bring the jobs back to America. You pay for the stadium, and I agree with you. Let the shareholders and the ticket holders be own a percentage of all the stadium. Otherwise, pay for it yourself.
Yeah.
The problem is, like I said, Tom, we don't make anything in this country, and we've got too much twatter and F-book, and everybody's just on, like that last guy said, you know, you're working minimal, you know, like Chuckle Nuts used to say, oh, you're working three jobs. That's uniquely American. We're going over the edge here. The lower and the middle class is this close, and I'm air quoting, pinching my fingers like a pinch of salt, is this close to going over the edge. Well, the rich and the corporations get far richer than they've ever been in the history of this country, and the gap gets further and further apart.
All right, and now you've got three sports billionaires wanting their communities to pay for brand new stadiums, and it's nuts. Rich, very, very well said. Thanks for listening to AM 760. Bob in Carson City, Nevada. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I wanted to say thank you for airing the views that you air. I haven't heard anywhere else but your show viewing some of the things that you say. And, you know, who was that said an informed electorate will make a decent democracy or something like that?
Yeah, it's a variation on something Thomas Jefferson said, yes. An informed and educated electorate is necessary for a functioning republic. And that's a paraphrase, but it's closer, yeah.
Yeah, and the corporations and the other media outlets are so focused on keeping the American public ignorant that it's incredible.
Yep. Look
what Jay Leno does, the man on the street.
Yeah.
Who's the president? You know, and
God forbid they should identify Syria on a map.
Yeah, really. Well, when I was 19 years old, I found out where a place called Vietnam was at.
Ouch.
And I didn't like that much at all.
Yeah.
But anyway, the all the stuff that's going on right now is the result of poverty. Poverty creates criminals in the world.
Yes.
You know, and we've had show after show after La Miserable, you know, was about somebody stealing a loaf of bread.
Yep.
You know, and since 2009, the economy has grown 23%, and since 1999, the God, I've kind of lost my train of thought.
You're talking about poverty and then the growth of the economy?
Yeah.
Are you trying to talk how it's all going to the top?
The wages of the middle class has gone down 9%. It's gone from...
In real dollars,
$51,000.
Yeah, yeah. You're absolutely right. And those, by the way, are household wages when you're talking the 50,000 numbers. Because the typical household has, you know, two point something wage earners, which is usually two people who are working three jobs. And if you go back before Reagan, the typical household had 1.3 wage earners, which was basically one person working full time, and maybe every third house had somebody also working part time. And it was the same level of income. So what's really amazing is if you look at household income from Reagan till today, it's relatively flat. If you look at individual earner income, it has collapsed. It's dropped by almost half. Because now two people have to work to make the same amount of money to maintain the standard of living that one person could do back when Reagan came into office. Reaganomics has just robbed, raped, and pillaged this country in ways that Americans are just now beginning to realize. Bob, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
The good news is Americans are waking up to this. Increasingly, Americans are waking up to this. I think the fact that President Obama couldn't get Summers nominated is proof of that. The good, the bad, and the very, very malachidermously ugly. The good. Glenn James, the Boston, Massachusetts homeless man, earned special honors from the city's police department on Monday for turning in a backpack containing thousands of dollars in both American dollars and traveler's checks that he found at a local mall. Hours after James turned in the backpack, police were able to track down its owner, a Chinese tourist, and give him back his valuables. In a written statement read at his awards ceremony, James said that even if he were desperate for money, he would not have kept a penny of the bag's contents. Some people are just good at heart, and Glenn James is one of them. The bad. Alex Epstein, the founder of the Center for Industrial Progress, appeared on Fox so-called News this past Saturday to talk about fracking. Most of Epstein's interview consisted of the usual industry talking points, but partway through, he had something very interesting to say. Check it out.
Fracking is actually incredibly good for our environment. Look at the places in the world with the best environments. They're the places that use the most energy because nature doesn't give us a clean environment. We have to clean it up. That takes a lot of energy to purify the water, to grow crops, to make the world a better place. And that's why I titled my book, Fossil Fuels Improve the Planet.
You purify the water after you pollute it? I don't get the logic. I don't know what world Mr. Epstein is living in, but pumping toxic chemicals into the ground is not good for the environment. And second of all, the idea that using more energy and pumping more fossil fuels into the atmosphere is somehow good for the planet is absurd. It's a well-known scientific fact that the burning of fossil fuels is the number one factor contributing to the warming of our planet. This kind of misinformation is laughable even by Fox so-called News' standards. And the very, very ugly racist Twitter users. On Sunday night, Nina Davuluri became the first Indian American to be crowned Miss America. While the pageant crowd cheered, Twitter exploded with racist commentary on her victory. One user, for example, wrote, "And the Arab wins Miss America, classic." While another asked, "9/11 was 4 days ago and she gets Miss America?" These guys couldn't even get their ethnicity right. All in all, their response is just very, very ugly. What a sad commentary on the state of dialogue in America. Charles in Opa-locka, Florida. Hey, Charles, thanks for listening. What's up?
Hi, good afternoon. How you doing, Tom?
Great. What's up?
Okay, great. You got a lot of interesting calls. I wish I could come in on most of them. But there was one where the guy, I think his name was Adrian, the caller that the special guest you had.
You'd have to tell me the topic. I'm sorry. Oh, Adrian. Oh, you mean the guest that I had, Adrian Moore. Yeah, at the top of the last hour. He's the vice president at the Reason Foundation, arguing against the minimum wage. Yes.
And I think how crazy that is for him to say, well, even the unskilled jobs, you know, they shouldn't have a decent wage. That's at least, self-sustaining. And this is as far as, you know, one job and being able to take care of all your bills.
Right. What he's saying essentially is that some human beings are not worthy, are not deserving of a reasonable standard of living, are not deserving of a quality life. And I find that offensive.
I don't know. Yeah, I do too. I think that's sickening, that's sad. And, you know, my thing is, well, you know, if everyone has a chance to at least earn that type of living, I think crime would go down.
It would.
You know,
it does in those countries. In those countries where you have a strong social safety net, you have much, much lower crime rates than here.
Exactly. And you never know. You know, you might be saving your own self, your own family member, friend, from, you know, something bad happening to them, from someone that's desperate that can't, you know, seem to find a way to take care of themselves. And last but not least, I blame all of these problems today. And, you know, I'm just saying, I blame the majority of this on these Sunday preachers that come on Sunday morning and, you know, ask for a donation. But it seems like they're in the middle of the divide. And if somebody can step up, you know, like a Charles Stanley or even that other younger guy in Texas, I forgot what his name is, but somebody can step up and say, well, this country has to come together now. You know, we want to find a truce. We want to find a middle ground where people can get affordable health care.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, where we can start making headway as far as jobs. Because I'm John Boehner, I'm still waiting on you and the conservatives and the Tea Party to give us the jobs that you promised, which you never did. You're trying to tear down Obamacare. You have a special agenda against this president. But you've left regular families behind. And I mean people that want to work and take care of their families, and they can't.
Yeah.
That is the biggest issues that we're facing today. And I'm just wondering, from a Christian nation or a nation that professes to be Christian, you know,
yeah,
right wingers, I'm asking you today, you know, I mean, where is your mediator that's going to come in and make a difference so that we can move ahead in this country today? That is the biggest issue. So, you know, I would like for you to expand on that, please, sir.
Well, I think you just did a brilliant job of it, Charles, and I agree with you. In fact, Shano says you're the winner of our book, or not winner, recipient of a book today. Let me put you on hold. If it's okay with you, can we send you a copy of Rebooting the American Dream, 11 Ways to Rebuild Our Country?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I appreciate it.
Great. Hang on just a second, Charles. I'm going to put you on hold. He's on line 5, Danielle, and we'll send you off a copy. But, Charles, you know, I don't know that I would necessarily blame Sunday preachers, although what shocks me is the number of televangelists and people like that, you know, of the Pat Robertson ilk who will sell his diet powders and his other products and, you know, his prayer things and, you know, please send us money. And he sold his network for $1 billion with a B. I mean, the guy's rich beyond imagination. And yet he's still asking for money, and then he comes out against government policies that would have us, we the people, do what Jesus argued in Matthew 25 when he said in the last days, or, you know, the nations of the world shall stand before me. Read it. It's in Matthew 25. If you're Christian and you're interested, even if you're not Christian, you're interested in this. And it's about the middle of the chapter, Matthew 25. He doesn't say the individuals are going to stand before me. He says the nations are going to stand before me. And those that fed me when I was hungry, those that healed me when I was sick, those that visited me when I was unjustly in prison or when I was in prison, those that gave me water when I was thirsty, those that clothed me when I was naked, which would be the modern-day equivalent of housed me when I was homeless, they will go to heaven, and the others are going to go straight to hell. And these preachers preach against Jesus, in my opinion. And I find that, you know, as a Christian, I find that offensive. I find that mind-bogglingly offensive. David in Chicago. Hey, David, what's up?
Hi. I wanted to thank you for touching on two of the sort of underbelly aspects of defense contracting, namely the guest worker visa aspect of the clearances that you have to go through the private companies to get a clearance instead of going directly to the FBI to get a background check and then going into the market. So just as the H-1B is sort of tied to the employer, the clearances and going through that process are tied to private companies, mm-hmm. and that has to be addressed. And then you also touched on a very important but not often discussed aspect of our labor market, meaning all these intermediaries of contractors and consulting firms that are taking chunks out of the paycheck simply by filing paperwork. Now, it's important to understand this because David K. Johnston, who you know, has reported on this on three different occasions from the early 90s to 2010 on Section 1706 of the IRS Code that was passed in 86 by Patrick Moynihan, the then senator of New York, who was trying to make up a $60 million shortfall to give as a subsidy to IBM's overseas operations. And he said, where can I get that $60 million? I'm going to go after these data processing people in the 80s and these independent software developers. And it was interesting that it was Section 1706 that Joe Stack, who flew his plane into the IRS building in Austin in 2010, that's what he was protesting. And David K. Johnston actually did a story about Joe Stack and Section 1706, one of three stories he wrote about from the early 90s to 2010. So if we're really going to start talking about tax reform, remember Tim Cook was talking about Apple's playing games with the tax code in his hearing last? Mm-hmm. Well, if we're going to talk about tax reform, we have to take away this Section 1706 as it
did. What does Section 1706 say?
Well, basically, it says to corporations, is this person an employee or a contractor? And it sets up these very rigid definitions. So the employees don't want to get stuck the way that Microsoft did in the 1990s by saying, oh, you've had a contractor here for 3 years. I guess they're really an employee and you owe them stock options and back pay and all that stuff.
Right.
So they set up this very rigid definition that that ends up these staffing firms just being tax collectors for the federal government. And the Indian outsourcing companies like Tata and Infosys, they've masterfully exploited this intermediary position by pimping in all these foreign workers. So it spawned all sorts of problems and empowering American citizens directly to the corporations.
Amazing. Yeah, I've heard David K. Johnson. Well, I've read David K. Johnson write about that, but I didn't really understand that subtle piece of. David, thank you for that. Thank you for informing us all. I appreciate it. It's such an honor to be here with some of the smartest people in the world. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
15 minutes before the hour, are Democrats and Republicans so different that they can't meet on issues like gun control? What do you think? 10 minutes before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Francine watching in Easton, Pennsylvania on Roku. How cool is that? Watching Free Speech TV's Roku app. Hey, Francine, what's up?
Hi, Tom. You know, you asked, are Republicans and Democrats so different that they can't meet over gun control?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's actually the perfect question because the part of the brain associated with fear is larger in Republicans than Democrats. And if you're coming from a place of fear, you're not going to want to give up your weapons. Especially when you see the police militarizing.
Yeah.
They're not going to give up their weapons.
That makes
sense. And another thing, I'm sorry.
Well, I was going to say that makes a certain amount of sense. And there's Joseph Chilton Pierce wrote a book called Evolution's End, in which, and I wrote about this in my book, The Edison Gene, about how when a mother is pregnant during the 9 months of pregnancy of gestation, the baby is constantly interrogating the mother, saying, am I going to be born into a safe world or a dangerous world? And the mother is constantly responding to that question with a chemical called cortisol. When mother's under stress, her cortisol levels go up. And when she's relaxed and calm and happy, her cortisol levels go down. So if the baby detects high levels of cortisol, what happens is the hindbrain, that part of the brain that you're identifying that responds to fight or flight and fear, gets overdeveloped. And the forebrain, the forward brain, the part of the brain that the Albert Einstein brain, the part of the brain that does, you know, thinking and as well as compassion and insight, that is stunted. On the other hand, if cortisol levels are very low during the 9 months of pregnancy, and particularly during the first 6 months, if the cortisol levels are very low in mom, then the hindbrain is actually suppressed somewhat and the forebrain is overdeveloped or encouraged to develop. And so a mother who goes through a non-stressful pregnancy will produce an intelligent, compassionate child. And a mother who goes through a stressful pregnancy will produce a child who's got a very hair trigger fight or flight response. And it's one of the reasons why I think for war is such a horrible thing. What we did in Iraq, what we did in Afghanistan, what we're talking about doing in Syria, because war stresses pregnant women. And they produce children who then will become warriors. It is a self-perpetuating cycle that's very difficult to break. Pardon my speech, but back to you.
Oh, that's really cool. I didn't actually know that. One thing, when you're talking about religion, I sort of bring up religion because I always associate religion and guns. I mean, when you're growing up with the fear of the Lord and the fear of hell, I wonder if there's some correlation there, too. Maybe that's why they're so closely linked.
It could be, or it could just be that it's that hindbrain, forebrain thing, you know, that fear brain versus thinking brain. The fear brain, you know, is drawn to the fearful religions and to the guns and to the Republicans and Fox News. And the thinking brain is drawn to, you know, good literature and you know, progressive television or radio and interesting discussions in the arts. I don't know, but that makes a certain amount of sense. Francine, thanks for calling, and thanks for watching on Roku on Free Speech TV. John in Sebring, Florida. Hey, John, what's up?
Oh, thank you, thank you. First, I want to say that I'm sure you've seen bums that are alcoholics, and you've seen high-functioning alcoholics that can have their three-martini lunch and make $1 million.
Yeah, I've known some.
The same thing is true with psychopaths. You can see some guys and say, oh, my God, that guy's messed up. And then there's other ones that you'd never know they're a psychopath.
There are psychopaths in prison, and there are psychopaths on Wall Street, yes.
Well, I wanted to say that there's a group of psychopaths that didn't want to go to the nut house, and that's why they closed down the nut houses. They're called Republicans.
Uh-huh.
And that other guy was talking about spanking.
Uh-huh.
Okay. I grew up with a psychopath. At 12 years old, my brother felt that my mother had no right to tell him what to do, that he was smarter and better than her, that he was above her. And my dad beat him and beat him and beat him until it got to the point where he gave up. He realized that beating him wasn't getting through to him, and it ended up destroying my mom and dad's marriage because my mom was like, do something with this kid. And my dad's like, well, I don't know what to do. I beat him and beat him and beat him. What more do I do? We have to find out something that we can do with psychopaths.
Yeah,
we have to either have nut houses or some sort of medical treatment to cure them or whatever.
Well, the way Aboriginal Indigenous societies work with them is they identify them, and very often they will isolate them. They will expel them from society, but they identify them. We don't even do that. We have a lot of psychopaths in politics and on Wall Street and at the tops of big businesses all across this country. And we honor them, and I think that that's a very, very dangerous and destructive thing. But, John, you make an excellent point. Thanks for calling and making it. Dave in Moorhead, Kentucky. Hey, Dave.
Well, hello, Tom. Been waiting half an hour to talk to you.
Well, thank you for waiting, Dave. What's up?
I'm 71 years old. I'm the last of 10 kids. They're all gone now. Mm-hmm. My dad was the oldest of 10. My mom was the oldest of 10. So I know what families are.
Mm-hmm.
Dad was German. Mom was Irish.
Mm-hmm.
Dad was well-educated. Dad got her out of a convent somehow and married her. But at any rate, they moved to Akron, had their 10 kids. And I got married and had my 4 kids, spent 40 years in big industry and maintenance in Akron.
Dave, we got about 30 seconds. I need you to get to the point if you can.
The point is, that's where the trouble is. Everybody wants to do all kinds of things to cure the violence. Doggone it, get back to families like we used to do. Everybody be at the supper table and go to church on Sundays.
Yeah, yeah. I think that you're onto something. Humans are social animals. We are designed to be part of family. I know Louise and I left Michigan back in 78, and I have 3 younger brothers who live in Michigan. And it's one of the regrets of my life that I haven't been closer to my brothers all these years. I try to call them on the weekends and whatnot, and that I didn't spend that much time with my parents, actually. I moved out when I was 16. I think you're right, Dave. Thanks a lot for the call. Coming up tomorrow, unending drought, increasing wildfires, extreme floods. Are you connecting the dots? Global warming. Do the math. I'll talk with environmentalist Bill McKibben, author of the new book Oil and Honey, The Education of an Unlikely Activist. Plus, this guy, you, California, wants to secede. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. You gotta get active. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.